Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Steve Marantz, a researcher for ESPN Content Development and E60, a co-editor of SportsMediaGuide.com, and author of Sorcery at Caesars, Sugar Ray's Marvelous Fight, not to mention being a graduate of Omaha Central High School. He'll speak on the topic, The Rhythm Boys of Omaha Central. Mr. Marantz's appearance was part of the Durham Museum's current exhibition, the 1968 exhibit from the Minnesota History Center, which will continue through May 4th. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 18th, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Christy Jensen, Executive Director of the Durham Museum.
Tonight's program offers a unique opportunity to see how the events and people that shaped Omaha in 1968 mirrored that of the national story during the same year. Our special guest, Steve Marantz, graduated from Central High School in 1969 and is the author of the book, The Rhythm Boys of Omaha Central, High School Basketball at the 68 Racial Divide. Steve joins us tonight as part of our educational programming associated with our newest exhibition from the Minnesota History Center, the 1968 exhibit. This powerful display provides an in-depth look at one of our nation's most pivotal years. I had the opportunity to hear Steve speak at UNMC earlier today, and I have to say his story is both humbling and inspiring. It's a story about kids making tough decisions and making their way through tough situations. I'm sure you'll be inspired as well. At this time, it's my great pleasure to introduce one of our sponsors of the 1968 exhibit and our hosts for tonight's lecture, Dr. Jack and Kathy Lewis. For those of you, sure. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Lewis has been the team doctor for Central High School for 49 years. Was I supposed to divulge that? 49 years. He is also known for his role in the Frazier-Stander boxing match in 1972. A little tidbit of information. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Jack Lewis.
Thank you. Well, I'm here tonight to introduce an amazing guy, Steve Marantz. You know, I was there. I was the doctor back in 68. I'm still the doctor. And we had our head in the sand. We didn't know any of this was going on. And he opened my eyes so many ways. I've read the book a couple of times. And to you people, I hope, have read the book. Earlier, I got a lot of people here. Warren Marquis's son is here. Jim Martin, the assistant coach, is here. Doc Moeller, who took over from J. Arthur Nelson, is here. These are important people. And I announced tonight that I am really important, not that I stopped a heavyweight fight, but I pronounced J. Arthur Nelson dead. That is the biggest accomplishment I think I ever made in my life. Scared the hell out of me, but I did do that. I was his doctor. So if you read the book, and I've got everybody here tonight in my group who has read the book, I want to tell you that I didn't know about Bagel Hill. I lived in West Omaha, didn't know about it, so I brought a bunch of my Jewish friends here tonight that lived on Bagel Hill, and I wanted to make sure that that's a true thing, and it is. So I can't do more than tell you this is a fabulous book, and the people at Central then, some of you, a lot of you, and most of all, the friends of mine, we were there. We didn't know about this and what was going on. So it was a big eye-opener. Steve wrote a fantastic book, and I hope if you haven't read it, you go up there and buy it and leave here with a book. Thank you very much, Steve Marantz.
Jack did not mention that he was the backup quarterback to John Brody at Stanford and threw a couple touchdown passes for Stanford during his career. So, normally I don't trust anybody over the age of 30, but after that introduction, I think I do trust Jack. I will trust Jack. To begin with, I do want to congratulate the Durham Museum on their 1968 exhibit. It's tremendous. If you haven't seen it, make a point of seeing it. It's really something. It's been said of the 60s that if you remember it, you weren't there. And to be honest, most of us who were there can't even remember what happened last Tuesday. As a matter of fact, on that point, my wife insisted that I buy a new coat for this event, which I agreed to last week. I went out and bought a coat, really nice coat, forgot to pack it. Stuck with the sweater, okay. Anyway, even if you weren't there, if you see this exhibit, you'll feel like you were there. And you'll realize when you see it that things have really changed a lot since the 60s. Back then, seeds and stems. Now, steel-cut oats. Back then, acid rock. Now, acid reflux. Back then, the Rolling Stones, now kidney stones. Back then, Bob Devaney, now, let's just skip that. In 2008, I decided to write a book about Omaha and the events of 1968. The story was one of the Central High basketball team, top-ranked in the state, and its African-American star center, Dwayne Dillard, and its great veteran coach, Warren Marquis, and its great assistant coach, Jim Martin, about soon to become a great head coach, and about their march to the state championship and how it was derailed by the presidential candidacy of George C. Wallace, America's most famous racist. Wallace incited a riot at the Civic Auditorium, which caused the North Side to erupt, and Dillard found himself in jail two nights before the state tournament. Those are the bare bones of the story. One by one, I contacted the participants. Among them was Dillard, who was in the late stages of pancreatic cancer. I interviewed Dillard 3 weeks before his death, and 4.5 months after he passed away, Barack Obama was elected as our first African-American president. And this is what I wrote at the end of the Rhythm Boys. If winners write history, I like to think that in the end, the Rhythm Boys were winners too. But Dillard's legacy is more timeless and universal than even politics. Like all of us, Dillard searched for love and acceptance. That he did so on a public stage only increased his need. If we could speak again through the ether, I imagine this exchange. Do you realize what you accomplished? I would ask. What? You were part of a movement that changed America. Changed how? We have an African-American president. No. Yes. And you had a hand in it. If George Wallace had succeeded, no telling where we'd be. There would be a pause. Thank you. Another thing I would say, yes. The Rhythm Boys were the best damn high school basketball team I ever saw. I'll never forget you. It was a long time ago. I see you clear as yesterday running the floor with hoop dreams and all of life ahead, forever young. Eternal youth, he would say? Yes. There would be a pause. That works both ways, you know. If we get eternal youth, our fans get the same deal. All of your fans forever young? Yes. Right on. Cool. Black palm on white, hereafter to here, skin would be given and received. That passage expresses the idealism and romanticism of the 60s. Eternal youth was the birthright of the boomers. As kids, we watched Mary Martin play Peter Pan on TV. Eternal youth was part of the deal. Idealism was part of the deal. Idealism could change the world for the better. civil rights, feminism, protect the environment, stop a war. The 1960s, as historian Doris Kearns Goodwin said at the 50th anniversary of JFK's death, was, quote, an extraordinary decade when there was a sense of really believing in politics and government and in public action, when people could imagine coming together and doing things to make the country a better place. And that's one view of the 60s. The other view is darker and more nuanced. The point guard on the Central High basketball team of 67-68, the team nicknamed the Rhythm Boys, was a senior, John Biddle. John was the son of Sadie and Dave Biddle. In the early 1930s, Sadie arrived in Omaha from Fort Worth, Texas. She met Dave, who came from Little Rock, Arkansas, and they married. Dave worked as a plumber and swim coach. Sadie was a master baker, probably the first African-American master baker at the brand new Union Station, now the site of this wonderful museum. Sadie and Dave bought a two-story duplex on the north side and raised nine children. Their eighth child was John, born in 1950. In 1962, Sadie and Dave put money down on a commercial building at 24th and Binney and opened Sadie's home bakery. Some of Sadie's customers, white and black, had been her customers here at Union Station. They followed her to 24th and Binney because her baked goods were irresistible. Sadie's home bakery was the unofficial clubhouse of the Rhythm Boys. When John's teammates came in every morning to pick up John on the way to Central, Sadie lavished them with hot sweet buns. At first, the bakery prospered. Those were good times. There were good times on 24th Street in the early 60s. It was a lively place. Gale Sayers described it in his book, and I quoted from that in the Rhythm Boys. It was just the place where there was a lot of commerce and a lot of activity. And at first, her bakery prospered, due largely to Sadie Biddle's grit and determination. Her shop was closed on Mondays. Other days, she arose at 2 a.m. to bake cakes, donuts, rolls, buns, and brownies. She opened the door at 6 a.m., closed at 5 p.m., and cooked her family's meals during business hours. Her husband and children helped her, but her 90-hour work week took its toll. John often massaged her sore feet. But the economic tide went against Sadie's home bakery in the 60s. The North Side's toehold on the working class, never too secure, began to slip. Dreamland Ballroom's closure in 1965 signaled a change in the North 24th Street economy, as well as musical tastes. Early in 1966, Ernie Chambers likened the neighborhood to a powder keg, which could blow up if conditions did not improve. When the North Side rioted over the 4th of July in 1966, the message was one of frustration and anger. Median income of black residents was one-third of the rest of the city. Residential segregation in Omaha was equal to that of Birmingham, Alabama. Large meat packers scaled down and moved out. Cudahy closed in 1967, and Armour was scheduled to close later in 68. Swift's closure was a year away. About 6,500 jobs, many held by black workers, vanished from 1955 to 1969. Unemployment was near 25% in the area around 24th and Lake, 2.5% for the rest of the city. Out in West Omaha, white Omaha, things were never better. West Roads went up, Nebraska Furniture Mart expanded, commercial and residential development flourished. In my mostly Jewish neighborhood, known as Bagel, which was between Underwood and Western and 57th and 69th Street, kids drove American muscle cars and went off to their expensive colleges. My older brother, Denny, a 66 graduate of Central, went off to Cornell. He was our family's first Ivy Leaguer, the Jewish equivalent of Jackie Robinson. We were so proud of him. I was typical of most Jewish students in that my first contact with black peers was at Central. I had lived in all-white neighborhoods and attended all-white schools. The only black person I knew as a child was our housekeeper, Blanche. When I started at Central in the fall of 1966, I was nervous and curious about black students, but mostly I was concerned about grades, girls, clothes, cars, popularity, typical teenage things. Like all teenagers, I wanted to fit in, but without a discernible talent, it was a puzzle. As a member of my Jewish fraternity, Gary Soroff recruited me as a manager of the junior varsity basketball team, and as I handed out towels, gathered uniforms, socks, and jock straps, pumped air into basketballs and charted shots and rebounds, and got to know Jim Martin, who was the coach of that team, and Warren Marquis, I came to know the black basketball players. Sometimes I would ride with another manager, Bob Jacobson, as he picked them up or dropped them off at their homes. This gave me my first close-up look at the black neighborhoods, and what I saw were people and families, not statistics or lurid news reports. I was a junior, dipping my toes into journalism during the year of the Rhythm Boys. Two of my best friends, Harvey Joson and Jeff Crum, were on the team. And here I pause to say that Jeff passed away 2 months ago. Those of us here who knew him feel a deep sadness at his loss. His father passed away 4 weeks after he did, Stanley Crum in Des Moines. So this talk is dedicated to the two of them, Jeff and Stanley. As a 16-year-old, I saw the events in my book play out. The basketball, the politics, the racial tension, the anger and sadness. I saw one of this country's great high schools, Omaha Central, turned inside out by a race-baiting rabble-rouser from Alabama, George C. Wallace. There were things I couldn't see at the time, such as the tortured biracial romance of a white cheerleader with a black member of the basketball team. That girl, Vicki Dallas, kept a diary, which she allowed me to use for my book. Here's the passage where she first admits to herself that she has fallen in love with Willie Frazier. My mind has rarely been in a turmoil as confused as it is now. My thoughts are completely disorganized, and I have nowhere to turn for relief. That's why I spill out my troubles to you, diary, in hopes that they arrange themselves in some logical and comprehensible form. The one fact that stands out in my mind is that I like Willie Frazier. The fact that he called me tonight and told me he liked me makes me extremely happy. But why do I like him? It's the same reason I would like any white boy. He intrigues me, and it would be a constant challenge to make us a very happy couple. For 1 second, I forgot this earth and its people and their society, and my only thoughts are of how attractive Willie is to me and what it would be like to kiss him and love him and be with him like there was nothing wrong with it. What I can't understand is how so many people can profess a belief in God and still be prejudiced enough to see a difference in men because of the color of their skin. But right now, in order to openly admit liking someone of a different race, I would have to fight not only the world and society, but my own family and friends. I will have to love Willie secretly. Every time I read that, I think, what an amazing writer for someone that was age 16. Incredible. I was 16 years old, and I carried 1968 with me as I launched my career as a journalist, first as a sports writer in Kansas City and Boston, then as a reporter of government and politics. I married a wonderful woman and raised two great kids, and through everything, I carried 1968 inside of me. In 2008, when I began to work on the book, so much had changed. Facebook enabled me to reach out to Central alum from the 60s. Central had a not-for-profit foundation and an alumni association, both of which helped my reporting. The ethnic makeup of Central had changed. It was more diverse than in 1968. The one thing that had not changed was Central's excellence. It still was a great American high school. Eventually, I caught up with John Biddle, whose parents ran the bakery on 24th Street. Biddle's college basketball career was cut short by injury. He got his business degree at Minnesota, raised his kids in Las Vegas, and made a career at IBM in the Omdahl Corporation. Sadie's home bakery shut down in 1988. After his parents passed away, he took ownership of the building and paid taxes on it, but it stood empty at the time I wrote the book and still is empty. John Biddle was bitter about Omaha's failure to redevelop North 24th Street. He believed the highway system was designed to skirt the north side, and he believed the banks had redlined the north side. After the riot in 68, Sadie's home bakery had no white customers. This is what he said. "Nobody came up with a commercial plan. I don't think the city wants business on that street. It all stems from those fires in the 60s. Once that hatred fired up, it was there forever. It turned out to be a vendetta against that area." He did not mention that the north side has a murder rate for black males higher than any city in the country. But one of his former teammates, Steve Moss, cited it when he told me why he raised his family in Anchorage, Alaska, instead of Omaha. Critics mocked the 60s as a nostalgic cliche, an age of good sex, good drugs, and good vibes, a time of monumental idealism populated by people who wanted nothing more than to give peace a chance. The bitter fruit of the 60s, critics contend, was the rise of political extremism. Moral standards gave way to hedonism and substance abuse. Family as an institution suffered. The Durham, in its promotional literature for their exhibit, said the 60s fueled a, quote, contradictory sense of identity for those who were there. The contradiction is within each of us, each of you. For myself, I know the reality of the 60s is ambiguous. But I also know that the mythology of the 60s is precious to me. I refer to a passage Central's principal, J. Arthur Nelson, wrote in the Central High Purple and White Handbook for the 67-68 school year, quote, "Just as it's always been, and more than likely always will be, this is a harsh world for most of us when we're out on our own. It is a world of fierce competition with those of us who are prepared and are getting ahead. Today, you are planning for tomorrow. Will your life be rich and purposeful, or will you drift with the winds of time? You are beginning now to make that choice. Life is harsh, Darwinian. We struggle and get by as best we can. Mythology in religion, sports, and pop culture helps us endure. If 60s mythology gives us an image of utopia, of expanded consciousness, social space, tolerance, individual opportunity, flower power, and good weed, I have two words for all of that. Right on. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I think we wanted to have a Q&A session. If anybody had any questions or comments, if you want to add your commentary about the 60s or about the book, your thoughts, your experiences. We'd love to hear what anybody has to say. Who's going to be first?
I was just wondering what the whole story was on. I remember this time, but not very accurately. I remember when George Wallace came, but then what all occurred to put Dillard in prison?
Well,
and what happened to the state tournament then?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was just hoping you'd buy the book and read it, but sorry. I didn't want to give it away. But they, the Wallace incited the riot, and it carried on into North Omaha. And then the next night, Dillard was in a car with five other young men, and they were arrested. They found firebombs in the car, and he spent the night down in downtown in jail. And on Wednesday morning, his mother came, and Ernie Chambers came, and they got him out of jail. And that was the day before the state tournament. And, Warren Marquis was in the middle of this commotion about whether Dillard should be kicked off the team for the state tournament. And Warren Marquis defended his rights that he had not had due process. You couldn't prejudge him, so he kept him on the team. And but he did suspend him for the first game of the tournament because he had broken training rules. He was out too late. So they played the first game of the tournament without Dwayne, their star player, and Willie Frazier stepped up, and they won that game handily. And then and the tournament had been moved down to Lincoln instead of at the Civic Auditorium because they were worried about security at the auditorium. And in the second game, Dwayne was back in the lineup, and they had a very tough game against Boys Town. It went into overtime. They didn't look like themselves. Something was wrong, something had taken its toll. And by the time they got to the state final against Northeast, which was a young team, and I think they had two sophomores and two juniors in the lineup, and they had lost six of their first 12 games. They shouldn't have even been there, but they had a very, very, very good coach in Ed Johnson. They played a very disciplined game. Central was off, and Northeast got the couple of breaks of a couple of marginal calls right near the end, and they won by 4 points. And it was a stunning upset. It would have been like, the Denver Broncos upsetting the Seattle Seahawks. Not really. No, not exactly. And it was a very, Central hadn't won a state championship since 1912. It wasn't like the recent years here. Central had been in a long drought, and they weren't to win one until Jim Martin's team won one in 1974. But Warren Marquis came very close, and it was a great disappointment. And they had to attribute part of that ending to the events of that week. When I think about it, for the sake of the story, if they had won the state championship, I don't know that the story would have been as effective. There was some tragedy, not only on the court, but off the court.
Yes, I was just wondering, 40 years later, as you come back to the city and you state some of the facts that you do, that you go down North Omaha and you see the growth in West Omaha, it seems like no matter how much times change, it stayed the same. Do you get that kind of feeling and the overall stats about unemployment, murder rates?
Yeah, today we did an event at the medical center, and Brenda Warren Council was there, and she said pretty much the same thing. Nothing's really changed, and somebody needs to do a book about what's going on there, what's wrong with it, and look into it, do some investigation. And I understand the concern and the frustration. I mean, I certainly don't know. I haven't lived here for a long time. But I certainly can sense the frustration. Yeah. Doc Moeller. Doc Moeller was the assistant principal in 1968. He was about ready to step up in the next year.
Yes, I was, and I read your book, Steve, and I enjoyed it a great deal. I had some mixed feelings, however. Maybe I read it with too much sensitivity, and maybe you weren't implying this at all, but I felt as I read it that anyone who read it who lived outside of Omaha, who didn't know anything at all about the events at the time, I felt they would conclude, and I think it seemed to me that you pretty well implied that we tried to keep Dwayne Dillard in school only to play basketball. Now, I may be wrong on that, but if that was the case, I beg to disagree a great deal, because we did everything we could to try to keep him in school to get a diploma. Unsuccessfully, I'm sorry to say, but that's the way it was. But if you really felt and you concluded from those you interviewed that that's the only reason we kept him in school, to play basketball, that's just not true at all.
Doc, I appreciate that. I understand the sensitivity. I think that was reflecting the viewpoint of one of his teammates. If I had reported it out more fully, I probably should have had you voice that in the book. Journalism, it's an art. It's not a science. And with journalism, hindsight's 20/20. There are a lot of things. If I could have a do-over with the book, I would. You mentioned a couple of other things there that probably misrepresented what happened. I remember when the book came out. So that's perfectly valid. And I think there is a lot of cynicism about athletes in school, particularly in colleges. But that certain athletes are exploited by the school, and then once their eligibility is used up, they're discarded and so forth. But I didn't mean to really. I don't think Central was that far along the jock path of those days. So I believe what you say. I do. I believe what you say. Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was very good. I had a question. Have you ever researched or thought perhaps of the impact that the construction of the interstate may have had on the ethnic communities of North and South Omaha at that time?
No, I can honestly say. I mean, I've heard people talk about it. I have no expertise in that area other than what I've heard. And probably, someone somewhere in Omaha, some journalist is looking into that, researching that, but I can't speak to that with any authority or expertise. Yes, sir.
That story was that these two officers, called them patrolmen at the time, were northbound on North 24th, were stopped by a woman who stated her son was just hit by a car. Those two officers went and put that young man in the backseat of their car, rushed him to the hospital. They also, which he survived, but they have now, they meet with that young man, I don't know if it's once a year or once every 2 years, to see how he's doing. So we did have a follow-up, and that was done by two Omaha policemen.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question there were, acts of heroism and compassion like that. But that you also point out what a tumultuous period that was. Very tense. So, and it probably was not an easy time to be a cop. And I tracked down the cop who arrested Dwayne Dillard on the night of March 3rd, 1968, and he was retired. His name was Raymond Schulte, and he gave his version of events. Decent man, put in his long years on the police force. I would never characterize cops as automatically bad or good. You know, there were some of each. So thank you for that story.
Steve?
Yes.
You mentioned some of the basketball players that have died. Did any of the basketball players of this great rhythm team actually go on to play professional ball? What were their eventual careers?
Dwayne Dillard went on and played a year and a half of Division I basketball. His arrest actually hurt his recruiting. That he was actually being recruited by some major colleges, you know, KU, UCLA, supposedly. But it could have been a combination of his grades and the arrest. They kind of lost interest. He ended up going to Eastern Michigan. Didn't like it. It was a small town. He drifted out to the West Coast. The coach of Cal Berkeley was going to put him on the team. He saw him playing in a local gym, but at the last minute, Dwayne came back to Omaha. His mother needed some help, or he missed Omaha. So he missed out that chance to play out on the Pacific Coast. And then in 1972, he tried out for the Baltimore Bullets, was the last player cut. He went on to play for the Harlem Globetrotters. And in 76, he had a short stint in the New American Basketball Association. But for what his promise was, it was a disappointment. Everything after high school really never lived up to what it could have been. And his family said that, you know, he carried that frustration with him his entire life. But he was the only one that was close to a pro career. He could have. Yes.
Thank you for coming to Omaha and blessing us. But my question is, can you give us a background of how the basketball team came to be known as the Rhythm Boys? And further, can you talk a little bit about the other members of the basketball team and a little bit of their history and how that they developed?
Yeah. The nickname came from a World Herald reporter at the time, a guy named Don Lee. Mid-season, they had this amazing showdown. Central was number one in the state. Creighton Prep was number two. I think they were both undefeated or had one loss. And all the media was beating a drum. They played on Central's court at Norris Junior High. It was filled up. The overflow crowd, they had a closed-circuit feed into the Norris Auditorium. The Prep coach wanted to play the game at the Civic Auditorium. They felt they could fill that one. And everybody was watching this game. And Central played a great game. That was the game where Central, the Rhythm Boys, showed their greatness. And Prep was a great team, a tremendous team. Central won by 13 points. And then his story the next day, you know, the World Herald had two or three reporters covering it. Don Lee coined this phrase, you know, the Rhythm Boys of Omaha Central played basketball like nobody's seen it played around here. And it just stuck. He used it one more time. Pretty soon, you know, that was the phrase you heard in the hallways. The guys on the team loved it. They started calling themselves the Rhythm Boys. They just liked it. Some of the students at Central that were sort of more militant at the time felt that it was demeaning, and they complained to J. Arthur Nelson that they didn't like it. Dwayne Dillard himself said, you know, if someone had called me a Rhythm Boy, I would have been pissed. But Rhythm Boys was cool, he said. And as far as the other guys on the team, number 24, Phil Griffin, he was a starter. He was sort of the guy that came in last. He was a transfer from South High. He was a weak side forward with a nice shot from the corner. His father was one of the first African-Americans hired at Western Electric back in those days as a machine oil or something like that. Willie Frazier, number 50, great player, great football player. He was, you know, the quarterback of the Central football team. and you read plenty about him in the book. He had the romance with Vicki Dollis. He also, part of the book is he had another girlfriend, white girlfriend, who was pregnant and had to leave school around the time of the basketball tournament. And she talked in the book and described her experience as a pregnant high school senior, and you can imagine how painful that was for her to talk about that 40 years later. Willie he didn't want to participate in the book, and that's fine. I totally respect that. He probably felt that, you know, it was a painful time to look back on, and he made a good career here, married, worked, had several jobs in Omaha, and number 30 down there, Roy Hunter. He was the guy that could sky. They used to say he could leap through the roof. You know, had great natural ability. His brother had been an All-Metro player, Jimmy Hunter, 3 years before him. Roy, you know, if Dwayne was out of the game, Roy would jump center. He was only maybe 6'1 or 6'2, but played the game like he was 6'7. And he went on to have a tremendous career here in Omaha with Blue Cross Blue Shield. He was in the fitness industry. He's been on TV doing commercials, raised a family. I think he's a grandfather now. He's just a tremendous asset to the community, and was a tremendous contributor to the book. Let's see. Harvey Josen, number 44. Harvey didn't play much on that team. He became a starter the next year. Harvey was the son of Holocaust survivors, Ben and Emma Josen. They had been thrown into work camps. They were born in Poland and been thrown into work camps early in World War II and survived somehow, and met at a camp. After the war, they were transferred to some camp, halfway camp in Germany, and met and got married and were sponsored by the Omaha Jewish community and came over here. Ben went to work for an upholstering company. He was an upholsterer, and Harvey's mother worked for a mattress company, and Ben had a tremendous drive and energy, and he would work, you know, 50-hour weeks, and then he'd go home and he set up his own upholstery business in his garage and would work through the weekends. And finally, he was able to open up his own business, move the family over to 46th and Cumming. And, you know, he worked and worked and worked, and he was able to get people working for him. And as they built the subdivisions in Bagel and so forth, he started getting a lot of business from the Jewish families. And he lifted his family by, you know, superhuman effort into the middle class and then the upper middle class. And when his son made the team, Ben didn't know anything about high school sports. He had never been able to play high school sports. And, you know, he heard his son was a celebrity at Central High on this basketball team. And he didn't believe it. He says, you know, but he was talked into the first game he went to go see his son play was the Central prep game that I told you about in midseason, that big game. And he said, I got to go see this. And he went down to Norris, and of course he couldn't get into the gym. It was sold out. So they made him sit in the overflow crowd in the auditorium. But, you know, then he realized what his son had accomplished. You know, he had made it at Central High. And, he was tremendously proud of Harvey. When Harvey graduated from Central, he asked him to go into the business with him, and Harvey did. And they built the business into a huge fabric wholesaling company and, you know, really became one of the great, great American success stories. Ben passed away 2 years ago at age 91, and Harvey's mother, Emma, is still alive.
Steve, what prompted you 40 years after the fact to tackle the book?
You know, I think I had written one book. I had written a book about, I had covered boxing for the Boston Globe for a time. I wrote my first book about Sugar Ray Leonard and Marvin Hagler's rivalry. And then I was thinking about what else I could do. I kind of liked the first experience, and I was actually out playing golf with Harvey Josen and another friend, Bruce Muskin, and we were talking about that team and what happened that year, and it just suddenly hit me. You know, this was in 2008, and Barack Obama was mounting his candidacy, and things had kind of come full circle from the 60s, and I was thinking, well, you know, if somebody doesn't do that story, it's going to get lost. You know, so many stories just fade into history, and I was thinking, no one's going to do it unless I do it. And so if I don't do it, it'll just get lost. So I said I can do that. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but if I start poking around, maybe the story will come together. So that's basically how it was.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Steve Marantz, a researcher for ESPN Content Development and E60, a co-editor of SportsMediaGuide.com, and author of Sorcery at Caesars, Sugar Ray's Marvelous Fight. He spoke on the topic, The Rhythm Boys of Omaha Central. Mr. Marantz's appearance was part of the Durham Museum's current exhibition, the 1968 exhibit from the Minnesota History Center, which will continue through May 4th. Special thanks to Patty O'Brien, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.